Good morning, everyone. I would like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare to order. It is Thursday, February 4th, and a rainy day in Oregon. I would like to know if there are members here, and I know that Representative Kanemer was here. It would be nice if I could have him testify first, then. Okay. Well, with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1010 and call Brian DeLashmit and Grant Higginson up, please. Oh, well, let's have let's just close. No, we're still open. Come on in, Representative Kanemer.
Where are we?
I think we're in. Right?
Are we in?
Yeah, 1010. Or, no, you are on. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1010 just temporarily and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1046.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. State Representative Bill Kanemer from District 39. And for the record, I am a licensed psychologist, but I currently am inactive. So I do not practice anymore. A couple of different things. I guess as I've been listening to the debate, I thought that since this is a very important bill for me and an important bill for the legislature and I think an important issue for the public, I'd like to clarify a few things from my perspective and see if you have questions or comments about my response. You know, during the session, this issue dates back to the legislature in 2003. And has been brought forward since that time, and it's had a difficult journey. Last time we worked hard, and I want to give special thanks to Representative Barnhart, who's also a psychologist. We worked the House well. I think we came up with a very good draft with 2702, and we passed it out on a 49-9 margin, and a bipartisan margin, of course, by substantial numbers. I think the issues that were before us were the lack of training in mental health for about 85% of the people who prescribe medications in this state, the need for better access, and the fact that this is a new approach that's working very well. And I have to say, I wish I were starting my career over, and I wish I had the opportunity, because I think it would have made a huge difference. It was complicated to work with physicians who were not experts in mental health. And as people are progressing in treatment, their medications need a lot of adjustments. And a lot of people were either under or over-medicated, and those were complications that I think would have been eased had I had this privilege and taken the opportunity and the additional exceptional amount of work. And I think the model of psychology where you visit with people is a good one. I guess I reflect on the difference in the model was shortly after my wife passed away after a 8.5-year battle with cancer. I went to see my physician, I think stress-related. I had a very severe cold, probably on the edges of pneumonia. And she talked with me briefly and prescribed for that. And then she said, you know, you look depressed, are you? And I said, yes. And she says, would you like some Prozac? Well, I think that was a good question, but I also think there were a number of other questions that 10 minutes don't allow. And I think that's the perspective that psychologists bring to this. Let's talk about what's going on and what is the best full range of treatment, which may include or may not include medication. But a couple of other things to the bill. We sent the bill over to the Senate on a good bipartisan vote, and here it ran into considerable difficulties for lots of different reasons. And there was a decision made to create a committee. And the notion, and I enjoyed reading in the Oregonian as they were talking Sunday about our this coming special session, about the deal, which was we were either going to have this compromise, which hopefully would make all parties happy, or we'd go forward with 2702. And that committee was comprised, and that was the bill that was accepted. And the committee was quite careful in specifying the nature and the makeup of who should be in that committee. And I think that was exactly the makeup. There were three from the medical community, there was a pharmacist, and there were three psychologists. And I think that was followed to the T. The second is that they were to meet with a mediator. And Donna Silverman is a mediator by profession. She's also a member of the bar, someone experienced both in law and in mediation. And she worked with this group, and I attended at least three of their meetings. And the first one in particular, I think, is germane to our discussion today, because during that time, they examined the bill very carefully. And they tried to decide how their process would proceed. And I have to say, to my knowledge, none of those people are elected officials. They created a process under the leadership of their person that they thought was very consistent with the bill. I think that was accurate. I think as a legislator, I would have had a little different process. And incidentally, I wasn't at liberty to intercede. So they made a process, and they followed that process. And that was a consensus process. I think as the process occurred, there were a number of issues that were difficult. The issue particularly of educational training was difficult because there were dramatically different perspectives on that matter. They eventually came to consensus, and they even created a process for determination of what consensus meant. Then the issue came up of who will be the regulator. And that was a very difficult one. And I watched as one of the medical people very skillfully threaded the needle. And it was either this will be under the Board of Medical Examiners or will not proceed. So there have been some statements that there were power plays made by various groups. I'm not sure I'm going to say that that's a power play, but what happened is the three physicians and pharmacists locked up on that position. And it was either no go or concede. I think the psychologist chose to capitulate on that matter. And I was there and I witnessed that. We can argue about the virtue of that process and whether that is not consensus or not. I guess when you all end up agreeing to it, I guess that's consensus. But it was a forced consensus, one that I personally didn't concur with, but one which larger parties said that's fine. And besides that, I guess I'm of the opinion, which not all members are, that a deal's a deal. And so then that's how that proceeded. And I think we came up with a good compromise, and I think that's the bill that is before you. I think those are probably the main points that I would like to make in clarifying how we got here. I'd like to encourage you to move this bill forward. I think, is it a perfect product? Absolutely not. But I think those who were discussing it said that they thought it was the best bill that under the circumstances they could generate. I believe that was the charge from this committee. And, you know, I'd be happy with the 2702-16 or with this bill. And I speak as a person. I think my associations have said that they are very supportive of the bill that is before you. I would be delighted to take questions.
Yeah, are there any questions?
Yes. How about elderly patients who are on a number of prescriptions, seven or eight or nine or whatever, and they go to a psychologist who prescribes a psychotropic drug or something to them, for them, do they have enough pharmacology knowledge to determine the interaction with a variety of drugs that a patient might be taking already? Are they able to determine whether or not there might be side effects in the mix of drugs?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, thank you. I think that's a really important question that we need to discuss. And I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I think we've had some interesting discussions that haven't always been accurate. You know, one of the things is that psychologists function under a code of ethics. It is unethical and therefore inappropriate, and you will lose your license if it is brought to the attention of the board, for one to act in a professional manner for which they are not adequately trained to provide for appropriate treatment and safety of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So, in your example, if someone is familiar with the treatment of the elderly, or let's use children, or let's use normal average folk, they must have specialization in that, and they must be competent to practice in that specialty, or it is inappropriate, and their license should be jerked. And it's really that simple. And it's very interesting to me, as a psychologist who was licensed in the middle of the 70s, for the most part, we determined whether we were a specialist. And originally, incidentally, I was a child psychologist. I didn't continue on in that vein. I didn't keep up my continuing ed. It would be highly inappropriate today for me to work as a child psychologist. I'd have a lot of updating to do if I were to go back. But you have to be competent to practice in that. And we have standards that help people analyze whether or not you are, if there is a complaint. Did I get to your question?
A psychologist would not be competent to prescribe a psychotropic drug to an elderly person who has 7 or 8 or 9 other drugs that they're taking without doing at least consulting with the physician of...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I'm sorry, I missed that portion of your question.
Yeah.
And I think that's an excellent question. You know, the standard for both physicians and psychologists and all professional people is if you have any doubts, you have an obligation to consult. Also, the other side of it is what I did all the time as a psychologist, and that is when I was referred a patient by physicians, and that was the source of many of my patient referrals, I consulted with them on a regular basis. And absolutely, in a case that's complicated where people have potential lots of other medications, you need to make sure that what you're prescribing, if you are prescribing, is consistent and will not do additional harm or will not interact inappropriately. That's an obligation. And you also have the obligation to ask. You know, just like when I had my little recent surgery, they asked, what medications are you on? Because they wanted to make sure that what they were going to give me for anesthesia didn't have a harmful interaction. And absolutely, that is the obligation. And to that point, you know, I guess a couple of other things that I would say, just as a matter of practice, and I think we should just have some frank discussions here. The phone calls that I used to have with my physicians and sometimes other providers that have prescriptive privilege would go something like this. Well, okay, so you think that they need to have medication. What would you suggest, Dr. Kennemer? That was an interesting moment for me because I would usually say, well, I do not have prescriptive privilege training, and I'm not licensed to prescribe under the law. Oh, I know that, but what do you you see people all the time? And informally, I would usually say, well, typically in this case, people may use blah, blah, blah. And they'd say, okay, and what dosage might they use? Well, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's really interesting. Most of the time, they would take that suggestion. It was not a recommendation because that would be illegal. But there was a discussion because, as we've discussed, 85% of the medication that is received for mental health is from people who are not experts in mental health. I think that's a fundamental issue that we need to get here. Also, I think...
And we need to...
I'm sorry to get a little passionate.
We need to move on.
But I guess another thing that I would say is... you know, we've been having a lot of testimony that this is rocket science. And I think every time I go to my physician, they don't necessarily get it absolutely right the very first time. And I remember early in my clerkship, which was a pre-doctoral pre-doctoral and pre-internship experience at USC Medical Center. I was under the supervision of a psychiatrist, and for about 3 months, I would write prescriptions under his direction. After about 3 months of experience, and I think, incidentally, in retrospect, I regret my youthful enthusiasm, and I think it was inappropriate as I came to mature. But on a regular routine basis, under his direction and at his suggestion, I would fill out the prescription pads after interviewing these patients and leave them on his desk, and he would sign them with an occasional review. But that's the reality of this.
Is your question
answered? Yeah, and I'm sorry. Maybe I've digressed.
We need to move on because we have two bills, but believe it or not, they're going to be very lengthy discussions on them. But thank you, Representative Kanemer, unless there's any other questions. All right.
I appreciate so much the opportunity to come and testify. Thank you, and I really would encourage passage of the bill. I think it's in the best interest of Oregonians.
Thank you.
And the agreement was we'd come out of the special session. Thank you all.
Okay. And I noticed that Dr. Lace is in, and I know, and I want to take those on Senate Bill 1046 who need to get back to their own profession. So would Dr. Lace come up to give his testimony on this now also?
I'm okay till 10.
We have another bill to do it. I just need to know anyone on 1046 that has a time constraint. Okay, if you're okay till 10, then I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1046 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1010. Rick, do you want to give us a summary of what 1010 is all about?
Thank you, Chair, and briefly, and I know there's a number of proponents here, so I'll just give you a high-level overview and defer to them. This would basically prohibit a person from practicing as a surgical technologist unless the person is registered. The bill then outlines the fees, sets forth issues such as what a health facility must do to ensure employment, prohibitions, and that type of thing. It does establish civil penalties and the like. This does have a fiscal impact statement issued, no revenue impact.
All right. With that, Brian, do you want to go forward?
The record, Brian DeLashmet, here representing the Association of Surgical Technologists. As you know, I also represent the Oregon Nurses Association, and I'll get that off the table. First, the Oregon Nurses Association has bought off on this bill, has now for two sessions. This bill has been in some form in front of you at least three sessions now. Some tough negotiations have occurred for years. With the exception of the Hospital Association last session, everyone else had bought off on the bill. We did substantial negotiations on Senate Bill 379 last legislative session with the Hospital Association. Believed we got to a point where everybody could buy off, and at the last minute were, I guess, a little bit surprised that there was still a concern that ended up holding it up. Therefore, the bill did not get out of the final days of the session. But let me talk a little bit about what this bill does and doesn't do. There's some witnesses that will come up and actually go through the bill and the need for the bill, but let me talk a little bit about this. You probably have heard that somehow this is going to impose some kind of a hardship on some hospitals. We have been very, very careful in the drafting of this bill and negotiations to eliminate what we believe is any hardship on any types of facilities. The specific place of concern was in medically underserved areas. There is specific language, if you look at the bill, at the bottom of the first page and starting on the second page, in Section 3, that deals with those hospitals that are in medically underserved areas and how they will deal with the situation if they're not able to actually get anybody that's certified to fill their slots. We believe this is a good faith effort to alleviate any concerns that the Hospital Association or anyone else would have as far as the continuing operation of the facilities and their ability to function in medically underserved areas. Let me stop very briefly and talk about how this language in this bill refers to medically underserved areas. As you're all aware, the medically underserved areas are established by the Office of Rural Health, and that is kind of a rolling definition. Some areas may come into that definition at certain times, and other areas may drop off. We believe that's the most appropriate way for us to get a definition that ties directly to facilities in these types of areas that may experience a lack of certified people to work in these kinds of facilities. The second thing that I would mention is that in the negotiations, one of the other concerns that the hospitals historically had is the original bill had them collecting the fees and have the responsibility for paying the fees. This bill does not impose that. The fees are paid directly by the surgical technologists. The hospitals do not have a stake or a hand in the collection of those. Those fees are paid directly to the health authority. The last thing that I would say in closing before the experts speak is that given the data that you're going to hear about infection rates and medical errors, we believe it's about time Oregon really passed this bill, stepped up to the plate, and did what we can do in this particular area dealing with those types of situations. And you will hear data from one of the other people that testify that will talk about the experience in other states after they pass this type of legislation and the reduction in infection rates and medical errors in those states. And with that, I'll close.
Thank you. Questions? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning in the Oregon Health Authority Department of Human Services. And I'm here today because the office that I am responsible for has healthcare licensing and certification, and we are neutral on the policy implications of the bill. However, in addition to the work that we do in licensing and certifying facilities, we also have a program where we certify and have a registry for hemodialysis technologists. So if this bill does pass, the responsibility for creating a registry of certified surgical technologists would almost certainly come to my office, and we would be building on the current work that we do with hemodialysis technicians. So the issue for us has not been a policy one. The issue for us has been one of resources. We do need money if we're going to run such a registry because there are responsibilities. Just setting up the registry, setting up a process for people who aren't nationally certified but qualify as a surgical technologist because of other provisions of the bill, setting up a procedure that we would go when we do a routine hospital survey or ambulatory surgical center survey, check on this issue to make sure that they were complying with the law, setting up a process for civil penalties, etc. So there are work issues for us that need to be taken care of. We have worked in the past with supporters of the bill in Senator Morissette's office and believe that the $110 every two-year licensing certification fee is adequate to cover our expenses. With that, I will close.
I noticed, colleagues, if you will look at the legislative fiscal that we received, it does state regarding the bill, and then evidently in the bill it assumes a renewal fee of $110. It isn't explicitly stated, but I assume that can be done in rules?
As I recall, Madam Chair, yes, it can, that it sets it at $110 and a renewal fee in rules, but at least for the foreseeable future, we would assume it would stay at $110.
And, Madam Chair, that is our understanding of what we had agreed to.
All right. And so I see that the expenditure for the health authority would be in 2009-11, $64,305, and yet you would have a revenue of approximately $99,000 from the fees collected. So it's a revenue positive.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other?
Madam Chair. Well,
Senator Morissette.
Line 44 on page 2 says they will pay a non-refundable application fee for $110. So that is in the bill. So that's a given.
Okay. Great. Any other questions? All right. With that, I would thank you. I would like to call up a panel, Catherine Reed, Catherine, is it Sparkman? Yes, and Deborah Turner. Whoever wants to go first, please proceed.
Good morning, Chairperson Monis Anderson, committee members. My name is Deborah Turner. I am the Government and Public Affairs Committee Chairperson for the Oregon Association of Surgical Technologists. We are bringing forward Senate Bill 1010. This bill is intended to require certification of surgical technologists, continuing education, and national recognition. The surgical technologist is the only healthcare professional which works directly in the operating room currently without regulation. As of February 1st, 2010, there are 453 surgical technologist programs accredited in the United States, with over 5,000 surgical technology students graduated in these programs. In this state, we have Mount Hood Community College, which is a two-year associate's degree program, and we also have Concord Career College, which is a nine-month program. Both of these programs are accredited. Concord College has a new program that starts every 3 months. Between these two programs, they have between 60 and 70 students that graduate each year. So we do not feel that there's a need to fill the operating rooms with lesser trained individuals, because with this amount, we have found that there are no more than 5 to 12 positions open in any hospital in the state, and with the 60 to 70 graduated students, it would be enough to fill those positions. We have found with discussions with some of our members that there is hospitals in the state that are hiring people directly out of the cafeterias, housekeeping departments, to learn how to scrub in the operating rooms. These people that are working in the cafeteria serving your food one day may be passing instruments in your surgery the next day. So the ironic part of this is that in order for them to work in the cafeteria, they have to have a food handler's permit. To work in the operating room as a surgical technologist, they do not need certification, registration, or licensure, not in this state. And I do believe that this would fall under risk management at the hospital, and I think that would be a concern. There is a grandfather clause which states that anyone working in the profession of surgical technology, 2 out of the last 3 years would be grandfathered in and be registered in the state. And this, it's also the ironic part is that anyone that's working as a tattoo artist, body piercer, they have to have a license to work. The mechanic that works on your car has to be certified to work on your car, but we don't have to be certified to work on the human body. I have been in the field of surgical technology for 34 years, 22 of those years in the state of Oregon. I've seen a lot of changes in the operating room. When I first started in the operating room, we did not have arthroscopy, laparoscopy, robotics, stereotactics, navigation. This position is very technical, and it takes someone who has been appropriately trained in order to know how to put this equipment together, to know how this equipment works, and to make sure that it's working properly for a safe outcome for our patients. All at the same time, the surgical technologist is maintaining the sterile field, passing instruments and medications to the surgeon. I am passionate about what I do. It is not just a job to me. I am proud that I can serve the patients each day, and I am thankful for the training that I received many years ago. Safety of our patients should be on everyone's agenda, and regulation of this professional will be a safeguard for our patients in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
Just very briefly. I just want to say that Deborah put an X on my right hip when I had hip surgery. Because I said, I don't want her to operate in the wrong hip. She said, oh, I'll take care of it. She also looked after my wife when she had knee surgery. And so we've had some personal experience. Yes.
Thank you. Who's next?
Good morning. My name is Catherine Reed. I'm a certified surgical technologist. I graduated from Mountain Hood Community College in 1994 and have been practicing in the state since, except for 2 years, I traveled out of the state of Oregon. I want to talk a little bit about situations that we've been asked to find. You know, why do we need to have a specific trained person being in the operating room? What happens when we bring in people that don't have a primary education? So I've been asking around since last we met in the committee, and I found four different situations that I'm going to speak a little about. One was in Bend. The situation was sterile processing employee. They're the people that take the dirty instrumentation, they clean it, sterilize it, make sure that it's ready for your next procedure. They don't know sterile technique. They're not taught that. They only taught how to make something sterile, not how to keep it that way. There was a need in the labor and delivery department to scrub C-sections. The person was transferred to the labor and delivery department and then taught how to scrub. There was a lot of distension that was created in the OR by the surgical techs in the main operating room at that facility. They understood that that was not an appropriate use of the staff, that they're not going to have that education. The training she received, hopefully she was trained by someone who maybe was certified. We don't know that. There's no regulation to make sure that she is being taught correct sterile technique and that she has a sterile conscience that is ingrained from day one when you go to a surgical technology program. I was in my own hospital. I went to our labor and delivery department to scrub C-sections. While I was away at lunch, there was a crash section. The CNA who works in that department scrubbed the case. There was such chaos in the room because of the need and necessity to get the patient into surgery and the baby out. A CNA who worked in labor and delivery, she was day one in her department, was unattended with four other people opening sterile supplies, and she was not competent to open sterile supplies. She actually, because she couldn't open the packages properly, began to throw the unsterile packages onto the sterile field. It was discovered, fortunately, in time before the procedure started, but at the cost of the hospital to the patient, I don't know. But she wasn't being supervised, and she was put in a position she didn't belong in early on. That CNA that scrubbed that case, I got to talk with her later in the day. I knew her because she worked as a CNA in the operating room. They don't scrub in the operating room. They're housekeepers with certified nursing assistant licenses. But when she went to the labor and delivery department, she was taught to scrub, basically how to wash your hands and how to put the instruments in a certain order. But she wasn't taught that she is the person who needs to maintain the sterile field. So when I saw her through the window and not in a position to be able to say anything, when I saw her miss a gross error by a medical student who was scrubbed in, blatantly contaminating the field, it wasn't noticed. And I talked to her about that later and said, did you understand and did you realize that happened? She said, I didn't know it. And should I have? I said, yes. Did you know that you're the person to call that in the room and correct it? She says, I wasn't taught that. Only where to put the instruments and how to pass them, and that they need to count them when they come out, and that the sponges get counted. She meant well, but there's not a basis to make sure they're trained specifically and that certain points are made. It brings me to the next point about each hospital needing to have its own protocols. I don't believe that they're set up for that. I think the association, I'm a member of the Association of Surgical Technologists, and there's certain protocols and things that are met, and they've been taken care of through the accreditation of certain programs. I think that's the right place to make sure that we get, thank you, I'll stop there with that. We've had a new employee at the facility I work at. She applied at a different facility in our area. She has a friend who works there, so she called asking for openings. She says, we did have an opening for a while, but they filled the position. The boss's daughter, she's a clerical person. We don't know for sure if she was a receptionist or secretary, but she works in the facility as a clerical person. She's had an interest in surgery. She thought it would be fun to be a surgical tech, and showing that expressed interest, they've trained her on the job to fill in as necessary. She works at a per diem type position. When they need someone to come scrub, they'll call her. And so she's not working at that job on a day-to-day basis. And currently, without our legislation, she's not required to have any continuing education. I'm very passionate about continuing education. Me personally, that's the most important part of this bill. You know, we all had to start somewhere, and these people who are on the job trained, I don't want to imply that they're not as well qualified as I am to do the job, but I want to make sure that we all continue to move forward, not backward, or stay stagnant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, with your indulgence and permission, Sarah Breckenridge, who is...
we'll have her as last,
all
but
right.
If you would go ahead.
I was going to do a national perspective since I am not a professional, and I thought perhaps the committee would like to hear from all of the professionals.
I'd like to end with her, if that's all right. Okay?
Absolutely.
So, are you going to testify?
I am.
Oh, good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Sparkman. I am the Director of Government and Public Affairs for the National Association of Surgical Technologists, an association of 30,000 members whose headquarters is in Denver, Colorado. I was asked to come today to give a national perspective on public policy. I am not a surgical technologist. I am not a registered or perioperative nurse. I am actually a recovering lawyer. I have practiced medical malpractice defense for about 30 years, mostly enterprise liability, which means I represented hospitals and their employees in defending medical malpractice cases. For the past six, almost 7 years, I have committed myself to the issue of surgical patient safety. First, on behalf of perioperative nurses, Sarah Breckenridge and others. In fact, this was the first state that we came to talk about surgical patient safety from the perioperative nursing standpoint, and then later on behalf of surgical technologists for this past year. Both perioperative registered nurses, which you'll hear in a moment, and surgical technologists have been relentless in focusing on the competency and the collaboration of the surgical team to achieve optimal surgical patient outcomes. It's an honor to join to support them in this endeavor. The Institute of Medicine says that 98,000 people die every year from preventable medical errors. 60% of those errors occur in the operating room. Those in the operating room range from wrong site surgery to retained objects to falls, medication errors, mispositioning, and, of course, surgical site infections. In the cases where patients do survive these preventable errors, the medical cost is in the billions nationally. Of the studies done on surgical patient morbidity and mortality, there is one significant correlation. The higher the education qualifications in the operating room, the lower the patient mortality. In the operating room, every practitioner must demonstrate an objective measure of competence, in most cases licensure, except the surgical technologist. You know what they do. You've seen mock surgeries here at the Capitol. Some of you have been invited and have attended surgeries in hospitals in Oregon. And some of you know it firsthand as the physicians on this committee. But who are those people behind that? Who are the surgical technologists? They could be anyone. The Starbucks barista, the Walmart greeter, the Jiffy Lube mechanic, the receptionist. Physician's niece who would like to have a cool summer job. Or in Baltimore, deli cart manager because the surgeon said, well, he should have a familiarity with knives. Or me, which is kind of a frightening prospect. So how has AST approached this issue? It is the single public policy issue nationally for this organization. We want to raise the standards for our own members. They are so solidly behind us. To determine an objective measure of competence for surgical technologists in the operating room in all healthcare facilities, and make that measure a nationally accredited education and a nationally recognized certification. We wanted to do it as simply as possible, to require that healthcare facilities hire only certified surgical technologists who have successfully completed an accredited surgical technology program. So we set out to design the most expedient, least intrusive, least expensive way to achieve this objective. Einstein always says, look for the second right answer. And we kept developing towards a model bill, which began in this state, as in all of the other states that we filed. We do know about laws and sausages. Everything has a way of moving to meet certain needs in different jurisdictions. But basically, it started the same way. The surgical technologists need to be credentialed because they are fulfilling such an important patient safety role. So AST, through its local state assemblies, has filed this bill, this model bill, in 11 states, passed it in 5. It is still pending in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Massachusetts, and, of course, Oregon. Additionally, this model bill will be filed in 2010 in 5 more states, California, Nebraska, New York, New Jersey, and Arizona, and in Missouri and Kentucky in 2011. Yep, I'm busy. Yes, we're serious. In all of those states, I think I'd like to talk about the experience in the states where the bills are passed. They were most recently passed in Texas and in Indiana and then before that in South Carolina. But in no state that has started through the process has there been a fiscal note. The bill is largely self-enforcing by hospitals. They have stepped to the plate. They are neutral, if not supportive, where the bill is actually moving. In most cases, they are supported by nurses, physicians, surgeons, nurse executives, and those participants in the surgical process. The American College of Surgeons has a public position and resolution supporting both the education of surgical technologists and accredited programs and certification by a nationally accredited certifying body. But what about data? It's important to all of you, and it should be, and it is important to us. You've heard today some stories. My saying is the singular of data is anecdote. And there are dozens and hundreds that we have heard and that we have relayed in hearings and in meetings with decision makers. But data is now coming down the line, and it's been a long time coming in terms of being retrievable by the public and also reportable by the institutions. And so in response to federal law and state law, largely in the area of preventable surgical errors, but particularly in the area of surgical site infections and hospital-acquired infections, data is on the way. In Oregon, there is a lot of data collected. However, it is not collected by and released by facility, but it is released in general by large hospitals, middle-sized hospitals, and small hospitals. But some data has been collected specific to hospitals, and I have offered you, Madam Chair, and the committee some 2 representative states where data is now available. It's from 2007. And which is about the most recent year, in 2008, and that is in Minnesota and in Virginia. And then just to summarize the data, in Virginia hospitals, I'll talk about quality. In Minnesota, data show that hospitals without credentialed surgical technologists had an adverse health event rate 30% more than hospitals with certified surgical technologists as a condition of employment. Those events from the data reporting include wrong side surgery, foreign objects, pearly, and the surgical adverse events that I enumerated before. A summary of that data has been furnished to the committee. Cost is another issue that certainly all states as well as the federal government is looking at in terms of the cost of medical errors. Virginia did a study on the cost of just surgical site infections. And the cost of treating and patients who acquire surgical site infections during their stay at the hospitals. Hospitals who require certified surgical technologists, let me rephrase that, it's easier. Hospitals who did not require certified surgical technologists had a 13% higher cost of treating surgical site infections than hospitals who required certified surgical technologists, who are, as Deborah has pointed out, responsible for maintaining the sterile field and to guarding the sterility and the sepsis of the procedure. The data is coming, and the data is compelling. And I submit that Oregon can certainly join those states that look towards the protection of the surgical patient and the elimination or reduction of adverse outcomes for those surgical patients by requiring that everybody behind that mask, scrubbed in around that table, has an objective measure of competence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very briefly. Would you get this data to Peace Health, please?
Yes.
In Oregon?
Certainly.
Let them
I'd be
know.
Happy to.
Because I've been told by Peace Health that there's nothing in it for us. Why should we even go to the bother of certifying people when we get nothing in return?
Well,
I think it's important that you get this data to and send it to Alan Yorty, who is the CEO of Peace Health, who is in Seattle, and I will call Alan and tell him it's coming. I've spoken to him a number of times, but I think it's important to get this data out to hospitals.
Well, I think there is. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Morissette. The data in Virginia, which is the financial data, was used by the Department of Healthcare Professions in Virginia. It is an agency which recommends regulation of professions. They based their recommendation to the Virginia House of Delegates, their assembly, their legislature, to pass credentialing, certification of surgical technologists based on the data that was collected in Virginia that supported their decision. That decision came down in July, and the proposed bill, which the Department of Healthcare Professions in Virginia is writing now, will be released on February 9th. It is based on the Association of Surgical Technologists model bill.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, panel. With that, I'd like to call Tom Holt and Doug Barber.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Holt, here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, here in opposition to Senate Bill 1010. Let me just say at the outset that, we're happy that there are people who care enough about their vocation to pursue voluntary certification and want to be good at what they do. It's beneficial for them and for the facilities that they work in, that they pursue that on a voluntary basis. And where there are sufficient numbers of certified surgical technologists, many of our members prefer to hire people who have been through the training program that you heard about and have the certification. But that's not available to everyone throughout the state. And that's one of the key issues for us. You heard a lot about patient safety in the prior testimony. The association was one of the key parties that came together several years ago to help create the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, where we report in errors when they occur, and they are analyzed, and reports come out of the Patient Safety Commission looking for, you know, system-type issues that warrant correction on a broad basis, so we can learn and from those errors. I mean, the IOM report that you heard about was an impetus a number of years ago behind that effort. But you also heard a really big number on errors in the IOM report. What you didn't hear is specificity about a problem that actually relates to surgical technicians. We have talked to our members about, you know, is there really an issue here? Frankly, we're not hearing that there is one. There is not a pattern of adverse events that we're hearing from our risk managers. There's not a pattern of adverse events that's been reported out of the Patient Safety Commission. We're not hearing a big outcry from surgeons that we need to do something to vastly upgrade the quality of the staffing in the operating rooms. And if anybody was going to sound the alarm about that, I would think it would be them. Hospitals have no interest in people having adverse events and extended hospitalizations in their facilities. Some payers limit their payment after a certain number of days in the facility, so, you know, financially it makes no sense, besides being obviously the first priority being patient safety. There's only five states have adopted this certification requirement, and I think that indicates, you know, that this is really not quite ripe yet. Certifications have their life. I think they are best when they are done voluntarily, and people can go through those programs, and eventually it becomes, you know, more of a standard. That doesn't mean that it has to be regulated. If the voluntary sector can get it done, that's far preferable. The core issue we have with this bill is one of flexibility and ability of hospitals to train their own staffs as they see fit. The only training programs that are available are in the Portland metropolitan area. There's one at Mount Hood Community College in your district, Senator Moss Anderson, and then there's the for-profit program at Concord. There are not programs in Eugene or Medford or Bend or other places where there is a need for surgical technologists. We don't actually think it's a bad thing if a facility can identify someone who has a lot of potential and may be working in a entry-level position to go through training at the facility and become a surgical technologist through the facility's own training. That's I think we should all support the idea that, you know, people can better themselves and move up the ladder and get better jobs, and if they find a vocation, that's for them to be able to pursue that. And this bill will get in the way of that. We really need the flexibility. The biggest concern that we've heard from our members about this bill is that there may not be certified people available. The supply may not be there, and it's handcuffing them then in the ability to train their staff appropriately and provide for patient safety in the ORs as they see fit. With that, I'll close.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of Peace Health in opposition to this bill. As Tom said, if this was a problem in our hospitals, we would be here pushing the bill, but we're not. And that's because in our hospitals, we have not seen that problem. The hiring process at Peace Health, certification, education for surgical techs is one of the qualifications that we look for in new hires. But it is not an absolute requirement for the job, and we believe it should not be. As Tom mentioned, surgeons are not known to be shrinking violets. If there were untrained, incompetent professional staff in their ORs, there would be a minor revolution in our hospitals, and that's not happening. We're not seeing the problem. In that sense, we think this bill, it really is a bill in search of a problem and not a solution. Thank you.
I have one question. back when I first was elected, we formed the Safety Commission because one of the glaring problems in this state is adverse events and medical errors in hospitals. And we were hoping that with this group that we could start seeing a change, and we haven't. I feel when you have 60% of medical errors happening in the OR, that maybe the hospitals need a little nudge to get going. And I know that ASCs, ambulatory surgical centers, have a very low rate of medical errors. They're very small and they're very contained. I toured the Legacy Hospital, Mount Hood Community Hospital in my city, and they are starting to look at these adverse errors, and they're taking one item at a time, and they're working on respiratory infections after surgery, and they're getting a handle on it. But I'm not seeing that generally, and I'd like you to respond. When you say you don't see a problem, I bet you every one of your hospitals has adverse events, and I bet you a majority of them are in the OR. So please respond.
Well, Chairman Sanderson, of course, medical errors happen everywhere, and we're not, you know, the preferable rate of those would be zero. There's an awful lot of work that's going on to reduce that incidence at individual facilities. At an association level, we have a very active quality committee that takes on specific projects and really is pushing it. In terms of Patient Safety Commission, our chair of the board has been actively working with the Patient Safety Commission staff to encourage broader participation in the reporting program, and to look at what are the low-hanging fruit or that's still out there that ought to be priorities for the Patient Safety Commission, things like that. It's a very, very active part of hospitals' work. No one has an interest in continuing to have high rates of error in any area. But let's not forget, though, that medicine is as much art as science, and things do go wrong, unfortunately.
Okay. Yes, Senator Morris, and then Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I come at this issue from the perspective of one who served in healthcare governance for, I don't know, probably 20, 25 years. And I asked my hospital, Samaritan Health Services, if this was a good idea. And the response was, I'm not sure what it would do. There wasn't a compelling need. On our boards, we have physicians, we have surgeons. We spend in our board agenda probably at least a third to a half of the time looking at quality indicators. If there are adverse outcomes, we mandate root cause analysis, and never have I seen in my experience a connection to untrained personnel. So I can appreciate the issues at hand here, but I'm my experience personally just has not demonstrated that there is a crying need here to create another level of bureaucracy, regulation, and $5,000 civil penalties.
Thank you. Senator Morissette.
I'm sure thank you very much. These same objections were raised to the nursing profession at different times. The nurses negotiate with the hospitals for better safety conditions, better hours, better staffing. In fact, we heard a bill the other day, our last session, about staffing in the evenings when they were understaffed and nurses leaving the profession. And my conversation with nurses who leave the profession was mostly because of the pressure in overtime and not enough staff. Now, there's a similarity here. because I think that there is a natural resistance by institutions to make changes that may affect their bottom line, and I think that's part of it. So this is nothing new. Practically every person who serves the public is licensed somehow, from the tattoo artist to the person you may hire to fix your house and found out that they're not licensed by the state, and we have penalties for that. We could be the best repairman in the world who you hire, but if he's not licensed, then he's breaking the law. So we draw the line on surgical technologists who have one of the most important responsibilities of anyone. And we say that, oh, that's okay. If you need to pull someone off of the clerical desk in case of emergency, which nobody may know about later on, it happens, but they're not going to advertise it to the world. Okay, well, you come in here and you hand these instruments. It happens. Now, I'm sorry that Doc Bates is not here, because he gave a very impassioned discussion of this at a group that we were in not too long ago, and said that the robotics, everything is changing in the room, and they need to have better qualifications. And he is supportive of this bill. And I'm sorry, I don't know why he's not here, but he was called out. But he is supporting this bill as someone who has that experience. So my feeling is that it's an institutional reflex against something that they've had over and over in the past for different groups who want to organize. This is not a union, it's a registry, but it's an automatic negative response to progress. It's denial. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Question first. Tom, do you know of a single case in the state of Oregon where a hospital has gone out and pulled somebody off the rack at Jiffy Lube and stuck them in an OR?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, no. And I appreciate the question, because I think some things were said about the way that hospitals go about staffing that are just way off the mark.
Okay, further question if I could. Would it be fair to say that even somebody who is a clerical staff person would not be thrown into an OR without some level of training?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, I'll say this, that if I were personally aware of a hospital reaching down to the reception desk and telling somebody to throw on some gowns and walk into the operating room and start handing out instruments without training, I would probably be on the phone to Grant Higginson behind me and about our licensing. I just can't imagine that anybody would do something like that.
Yeah, thank you. Just a comment, Madam Chair. I've spent a lot more time in the last 6 months in my local hospital than I want because of my mother's health issues, and I've talked to folks in there, because you got a lot of time, about a lot of issues, and I've talked to a lot of my surgeons, and what I don't want to do is set up a scenario where somebody else potentially is determining who somebody scrubs with, and the surgeons in my community don't have issues, they don't have problems. They have their scrub team, they're comfortable, and I quite honestly, I think this is a solution in search of a problem from all the anecdotal information I have been able to gather.
Thank you. Thank you, panel, very much. And with that, I'd like to call up Sarah Breckenridge, RN.
Thank you, committee, Senator Monis Anderson, Senator Marisette, the rest of the committee. I've been here before, and I am very happy to be back again. My name is Sarah Breckenridge, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1010. I'm a registered nurse,
certified in my specialty, national certification, who has worked in the operating room setting since 1972. I trained at OHSU. My first job was at OHSU for 20 years and 15-plus years in several small hospitals in Lincoln and Yamhill counties, Ambulatory Surgery Center in Tualatin, and I currently work in a medium-sized hospital in Washington County. I'm director of outpatient surgery there. My experience ranges from staff nurse to department director. I represent myself and my patients. I've worked extensively with my surgical technologist colleagues throughout the process of developing this piece of legislation. Accredited academic preparation of the surgical technologist is essential for patient care. We've heard about that discussion. We work in an environment where we prepare for war and pray for peace. Patient safety is my passion, and I ask that you consider the serious nature of what my colleagues and I do in our everyday practice in the care of the surgical patient. And I'm talking about the operating rooms itself. As a director of a perioperative unit, I've interviewed and hired many surgical technologists. I can tell you there is a huge difference in the skill and knowledge base of the on-the-job prepared surgical scrub, 6 weeks preparation maybe, to those who have had an accredited academic training, associate degree as a surgical technologist. I'm going to divert a little bit from my letter because I wanted to respond to some of the information that was given here. In these current economic times, as a director of an outpatient surgery unit, we're pushed to do more with less. Daily productivity is our key. Have we met our productivity? Have we not? And when I have to staff an operating room with fewer people than I have before, that means there's less eyes on the patient and what's happening. We also talked about certification. The certification we're talking here, there's two definitions of certification. I am nationally certified in my specialty. That is a voluntary certification. We're also talking about a regulatory certification. We can't mix up the two. What we're trying to do here is make sure that all the people who practice as surgical technologists in the state of Oregon have a regulatory certification so we're able to track and make sure that they meet minimum education requirements and continuing education requirements. It's not about a national voluntary certification. A lot of our surgical technologists do have their national their voluntary certification, just as I do, but that's a voluntary thing. I have my license. It's required to be able to do the job that I do. I'm looking for my colleague who is working right side by side with me in the operating room is to also have a minimum standard requirement, and that's the regulatory certification piece that we're talking about in this bill. The focus of this bill is to place responsibility of the employer to hire only qualified surgical technologists. Your constituents deserve a standard of care that is consistent whether they have their surgical procedure in a single operating room, ASC, or in a large hospital multi-specialty operating unit. The technology is there. It's changing. We talked a little bit about that they haven't heard incidents reported. Well, we're talking about discussions at the board level. We're talking about the discussions at the association level. I'm talking about the level of where the patient is actually having his procedure done. It's the day-to-day working together as a team. I have to be able to trust that surgical technologist knows what they're doing. And one way of being able to know that they've had adequate preparation is that they are a graduate of an accredited program. That gives me a baseline. That doesn't guarantee, but it gives me a better baseline than if I hired, of which I've had applications from the jobs that I have posted right now, from on-the-job trained surgical technologists. I don't know what their basis is. I have to spend the time to evaluate that. I don't have that time to be able to do. I want to know that they're a graduate of an accredited program. This kind of data doesn't get to the board. This kind of data doesn't get to the associations. The breaks in technique, the near misses don't always get to those that are manipulating the data. I see it on a day-to-day basis. If I have a surgical technologist that knows what they're doing and can call the breaks in technique or to be able to avoid the technique and work with their surgeons, those are the ones that we want. Those are the ones you want taking care of your mother, taking care of you, taking care of your father. I ask your support as a patient advocate and as a member of the team in the operating room. I must have confidence that my coworker has an understanding of the complexities of the environment and the standards that are foundation of our combined practice. We all have a lot to do during a surgical procedure, and time is of essence. When I am circulating, I do not have time to worry if the surgeon knows what he or she is doing. I leave that to them and their training. I also do not have time to keep my eye on 100% on the surgical technologist. My eye is on the patient. This is a win for everyone, and especially for the patient who is at their most vulnerable time and expects that everyone they have trusted the very essence of their life is fully prepared to care for him and her. I could say a lot more, but the bottom line is, what we're talking about is what's going on in the operating room. Data gets developed, we look at that, and that helps. But what happens in the operating room and the collegiality of the team and the skill level of the team is what counts for the immediate outcomes of that individual patient. And I ask for you, thinking about when you go to the operating room, do you want someone who was formerly a barista at a Starbucks to be the specialist in your room? And I can tell you a very personal experience of that, and I've shared it with this committee before, where contract services, of which we use, because in some of the smaller hospitals, say ophthalmology, we bring in these specialty services, of where my son, who is the barista, was approached by the owner of a company who said, I'll train you, I'll give you a few weeks training, and then you go in and you go in and do the service, and you're scrubbing on eye cases. Now, the barista is a specialist in the room with 3 weeks preparation. That person should be a graduate of an accredited program. Thank you.
Question. Thank you very much. With that, I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill. Well, before I do that, I would like to know where the Minnesota data came from. It's not cited where the stats came from on the Minnesota data. So if I could, at some point, just let them know where that data came from. The Virginia data, it is cited. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1010, and I'm going to wait for Senator Bates before we go into work session. With that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1046, and Mr. Bercovian, would you please tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 1046, that you did here on the 2nd of February does allow licensed psychologists to be eligible to prescribe certain medications that are established under a formulary. It does establish a committee on prescribing psychologists within the Oregon Medical Board. Does establish timelines for review or process of the applications. There are a couple sets of amendments pending right now on the bill. I'll stop.
Okay. With that, I'd like to call Laurel Singer in because she needs to give us some clarification on the process, I believe.
Good afternoon or good morning. Laurel Singer. I'm with Oregon Consensus. Thank you, Senator, and hello to the committee members. I am the program manager at Oregon Consensus, and we were approached by the sponsors of from House Bill 2702 to help facilitate the work group that would be looking at the issues around prescriptive authority. And I know some questions came up in the hearing yesterday about that process, and I just wanted to clarify that work group members, and I don't want to really speak to the content, but just the process, that the work group members were appointed to be on that committee not as representatives of any particular interest, but because of the expertise and the perspectives that they might be able to bring. They were specifically designated by the House bill to look only at the training and oversight of this prescriptive authority and what that might look like. They were not really addressing, and they were not asked to address, the issue of whether licensure should be granted or not. And I just want to really compliment the work group members for really
in really trying to do their best with the task they were entrusted to do, and keep their personal perspectives and beliefs aside as they really tried to look at their expertise and work collaboratively and in good faith with the other work group members. So I really wanted to talk a little bit about that process and answer any questions that may still be pending about that. A very different process than if you were to look for members of interest groups to come together and try to hash out the question of whether this should or shouldn't go forward. This was simply to focus on what would the prescriptive authority training oversight costs look like so that it could be factored into a decision about whether it should move forward or not. So I just want to see if there's any questions I could answer about that.
We don't have all of the members here, but are you able to stay?
Oh, certainly.
Okay. So if there are questions, we'll call you back up.
Great.
All right. All right. A lot of opposition, so I'm going to go with the opposition to the bill first. And I'd like to call Dr. Lace and Dr. Pollack and Dr. Stuart Newham. Let's start with you three.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I represent the Oregon Medical Association today, and I'm a practice pediatrician here in Salem, and also represent the Oregon Pediatric Society. First out, we want to state that at this point in time, the Oregon Medical Association is now opposed to Senate Bill 1046, as it is. We fundamentally believe that the psychologists don't have adequate medical training to prescribe the psychoactive medications, and while this is another attempt to further that training definition, it doesn't go far enough in our estimation. In terms of the work group process, the OMA was not represented. We did provide comment and some issues that we wanted to be addressed, but none of the recommendations were included in the final bill, in Senate Bill 1046. It's a very complex issue, and there are many concerns with the final work group proposal. We have written testimony in front of you. I'd just like to make some comments along the line. First off, I was a barista in college, and so training afterwards to become a doctor. But we don't want to hit on the baristas too much, you know, because they have value in our society. Clinical, you know, the preclinical training, Senate Bill 1046, they must have either a master's degree in psychopharmacology or complete a Department of Defense program. But there's not, as it currently interpreted as we read it, there's not enough adequate training on basis of anatomy and biology. There should not be the telephonic preclinical training either. There may be telephonic consultation done during the prescriptive administration, but not as part of a training procedure. The clinical training, we've written down our concerns with that. It's not real clear along that line, you know, how that's going to be done. There should be at least three supervising physicians that will oversee the applicant's clinical training. I'm a pediatrician, and I can tell you firsthand, we have some huge issues with this with kids. We worked with you on House Bill 3114 last session. If you remember that bill, that was to allow DHS oversight in how psychoactive drugs are prescribed to children. And currently, it's not totally worked out yet, but right now we have a three-page review process that I'm glad to fill out. These are patients that we take care of, and the list of their medications are on there. We have to specify why they're on there and make sure that it's clear and look at alternatives. The intent of that was that, first out, the comment was made that oftentimes children, and these are children, 3114 only deals with children in foster care, but these are it's a very volatile population, and they have a lot of medical as well as psychological needs. But the comment was made that these kids are often over-prescribed medications routinely, and so that's the intent of having oversight. And I can tell you from what I get and what we see, we get kids that come into our office that are on 6 different psychotropic drugs. It's not clear to me why we would at this point want to expand the basis of people who are prescribing medications when we already acknowledge that there's an existing problem.
Dr. Lace, yes. With those children, who's prescribing them? Is it the general practitioners or nurse practitioners, or who is prescribing them those? Someone.
Okay. Oftentimes these kids are coming out of group settings or group homes, or they may have been in another group setting, or they may come from another state. In another state, it's the variety of people. In this state, the people that can prescribe these drugs right now are currently MDs, DOs, and certified nurse practitioners, basically. So that's the group, basically, that does the prescribing. And when those kids come in, we have a big shortage of residential facilities, and these kids will go in, they'll be in a setup, you know, for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they'll come back out, and they'll be on something that seems to work, but not always being able to take into account, you know, a stable situation. And so they'll have oftentimes 2 antidepressants in the same family, 2 neuroleptics, you know, which are things like risperidol, Abilify, Geodon, Zyprexa, things that have major side effects, and then 2 other medications that are often, you know, for treating ADHD drugs. So it's not uncommon to have these all 6 all at one time. We have to sort through this because of all the side effects with all these medications. I just got a phone call yesterday from a grandma, one of my patients. This child is on a drug that has major side effects with obesity, fatty liver, and other things, but it's to control her autism and some of the other side effects, some of the other problems that she has. This child now has preclinical type 2 diabetes with all the attendant things, because galactorrhea and some of these other major side effects because of the medication. And she asked me, what should I do? And my first impulse is stop the medication because it's obviously, you know, having all these bad side effects. And so that's the reality of all this. And so who gets asked in this position, who gets stuck in the position of having to review the side effects, to review the impact of the medications on these kids? It's oftentimes the primary care person. We do, in our pediatric office, we have a psychiatrist that comes in on a monthly basis who reviews cases with us eye to eye. Sit down here in a chair, we talk these over. We have our program that we started up with the child psychiatrist here in the state, where we have ongoing ability to call them up, review a case with them, or send them a case too if we need help. So we have a good collaboration that's going on there. But kids are very different than adults, and I appreciate Senator Morissette's comments before, and other people that have had any members of their family in the hospital. My 95-year-old father-in-law was continually over-prescribed medication, and when these people get over 80 years old, their responses are so different than the average age group that most people think about needing medications. That's another whole area that I'm not an expert in, but I can tell you from personal experience, and even my own father before he died, we routinely went through major side effects with that, and because people don't have a lot of experience. They're not used to having people live to be 90 years old and be on different medications. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we had recommended is that this not include children less than 16, because this is a very complicated area, and we continually ask for consultation. We continually ask for reevaluation with the psychiatrist on these kids because of the side effects of these medications. We thought that the committee should be composed of equal number of physicians and psychologists, and there should be at least 2 psychiatrists on the committee, and also maybe even put a public member in there to break a tie vote if there would be a tie vote. The whole issue about working in collaboration and liability, it's not really addressed. And the assumption is that whoever's going to prescribe these medications is going to be connecting with the primary care physician. And if they're on 6 or 8 or 10 different medications, that somebody's keeping track of all that and who's going to be liable for that. We don't think that the liability concerns are addressed. And, you know, we have, in the state, as you know, we have no cap on, and constitutionally mandated no cap on our liability. And so we feel under the gun and feel that we don't have any necessary protection that's built in on this. And so it's a complicated issue. We appreciate the time. We appreciate the effort that people have spent on this, and we realize that this is not the first go-around, and this is many times going around, and we know that there's a shortage of skilled people in the community. We love people who actually talk to our patients. We love people who spend time with them and counsel them. We seem to have, at least in my experience, enough people that are willing to hand out prescriptions, but we don't have enough people that are willing to counsel and go through talking. And so I don't see a great, you know, pressing need for this in the pediatric community. And if anything, I'd like to encourage more people to go into child psychiatry, child psychology, and to work with us in helping these kids. And also to take the Oregon Health Plan. That's another issue about who will accept patients and who is entered into the whole matrix of care for these kids. So with that, I'll stop and be ready to answer questions.
Thank you. And we do have 9 more people that need to testify. I believe I counted them all, so that would be maybe about 3 minutes apiece. But still, I want to have, if don't repeat maybe what someone ahead of you already said.
I'll do my best. My name is David Pollack. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm a professor for public policy at OHSU, and I think I should establish my credentials a bit, because I think issues of credentials have come up in regard to participation in this process, and I just want to make it clear. I've been in the state for 36-plus years. I've actually been doing things in all aspects of the healthcare system. Some people consider me the Forrest Gump of public psychiatry. But I work at OHSU, training medical students, training psychiatry residents, and training family medicine residents in particular, something I'm doing right now in terms of working with them and seeing patients and helping them learn how to do psychiatric evaluations. So one of the things I want to address is how and whether primary care providers can do a good job. I also was the medical director for the state's addiction and mental health division for 4 years, up until about 3.5 years ago, and can actually answer the question that Dr. Lace was asked about who's prescribing these drugs for kids, if you want to get to that later. I want to talk about the process a little as well. So we, from the Oregon Psychiatric Association's perspective, had been participating, trying to support what could happen. We think the process that you had laid out, Senator Manas Anderson, was a reasonable one in terms of how do we resolve these scope of practice issues. We just think the process got sidetracked in some way. So I don't think it was the process that you had imagined and designed. It somehow got taken over in another way, and we're troubled by that. So that's why we're now opposing the bill. The issue around who is doing the prescribing and who supervises it, we think, as others have said, I'm not going to repeat, safety issues are paramount, and that's what we really are concerned about. But because of the complicated nature of the conditions and the comorbidities that occur in persons who have psychiatric issues, it is really essential for whoever's doing the prescribing to have a sufficient medical training background. So, in my view, family practice and pediatrics physicians are much more adept and capable, with appropriate consultation, as Dr. Lace has referred to provide this kind of prescribing support. The family medicine doctors that I'm working with, the residents and the staff at the OHSU family medicine clinics, are doing a really good job. We like working together. They know how to access support. We need more psychiatrists, no question, and we need more psychiatric prescribing capabilities, but not in the fashion of creating people who really don't have the medical background to do it. The other area that relates to this is another thing that I'm doing. I'm active in the Oregon Health Policy Board and Oregon Health Authority process, and I'm on 2 committees related to the Health Policy Board. One is the Patient-Centered Primary Care Home Standards Committee, which just has finished its meetings, and you should see its proceedings. We've come up with what we think are some really reasonable approaches for how does one define a primary care practice that is a primary care home, how do we integrate mental health and primary care in that process, and nowhere in that process has it come up that people are thinking we should be having psychologists doing the prescribing. We certainly should have co-located behavioral health, mental health and addiction specialists in those settings, and primary care providers co-located in community mental health program settings, for example, to have these homes. But nowhere has it come up that that's an appropriate avenue to go ahead with. The other committee I'm on is the Healthcare Workforce Development Committee, and we're going to start meeting at the end of this month. And I will assure you that we'll be thinking about a variety of these issues, who it is that we need to be training, how many people should we be bringing into the pipeline, into the healthcare system, what kind of core competencies should they have, and what curricula should they be having to achieve those competencies. And I'm really dubious about whether or not there's going to be an appropriate role for psychologists prescribing, except in the way that would be part of a team, a multidisciplinary team where there might be oversight from a physician in that practice. As Dr. Lace mentioned, the consultation between providers is so important. I have been working along with a number of other folks to provide through OHSU and other resources consultation, curbside or ad hoc kind of consultation for prescribing providers from psychiatrists. Both adult psychiatrists and now the child psychiatrists and pediatricians are working in a similar fashion. I participate in that group. In fact, our next meeting is tomorrow morning. So all of that has been going, I think, very well, and it will continue. We have a lot of room to go. But this is, I think, consistent with what Senate Bill 2009 had tried to address and what a number of you have been concerned about in that regard. So if you want, at some point I can answer the questions about who's prescribing drugs for kids, because we did a study when I was medical director for the state mental health and addictions division about that. But I'll stop at that and wait for questions.
My name is Stuart Newman. I'm a child psychiatrist in private practice in Beaverton with a group called Mind Matters. In hearing testimony about 1046, I know you've been told about the problems with access to quality psychiatric care, and I wanted to highlight a couple of the initiatives that the medical community has been making in order to address those issues. As Dr. Lace indicated, the Oregon Pediatric Society, in conjunction with the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, has begun to develop a collaborative program where we maintain consultative relationships between child psychiatrists and pediatric practices. This allows the pediatricians at their need to have a working relationship with a child psychiatrist who they can then consult with and at times even allow for speedy referrals if specialist level of care is necessary and appropriate. At the practice that I am part of at Mind Matters, we are continuing to use telemedicine technology as well to provide psychiatric services throughout the state. The technology allows us to evaluate new patients, to provide ongoing care, and obviates the need for patients to travel to our office in order to receive their care. And thanks to the efforts of the legislature last year, these services can now be billed to insurance companies in the same way that regular office appointments are billed. Mind Matters also recognized that specifically for child psychiatry services, there was a significant need in the state, and so we have opened a second branch office in Pendleton. We have a nurse practitioner and a counselor who work there several days a week, and one of our psychiatrists, Dr. David Conant-Norville, flies to Pendleton on a weekly basis to see patients, to supervise care, and then also uses our telemedicine technology to consult and to provide emergency care when necessary. the supporters of Senate Bill 1046 would have you believe that the only solution to the problems with access in the state are to provide more prescribers who are less than adequately trained, and we would like to respectfully suggest that there are other alternatives that can continue to provide high-quality psychiatric services to all Oregonians. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Tanya Tompkins, Doug Barber, and Dr. Robert Julian.
For your time and consideration. Can you all hear me? I'm Tanya Tompkins, for the record. I earned my PhD from UCLA and completed internship at the Resnick Neuropsychiatric Institute Hospital. And I moved to Oregon almost 8 years ago now to teach at Linfield College, so I'm an educator. I serve on the Yamhill County Commission on Children, Families, and chair our Suicide Prevention Coalition, so that gives you a bit about my background. And I have five main concerns that I don't think have been addressed since this issue was initially raised in 2003. The first is that psychologists, if you haven't gathered, and I think the turf issue between psychiatrists and psychologists is very clear, but what's less clear is that psychologists are deeply divided about shifting our profession from a biopsychosocial training to medical training. And I would argue legislators should not get involved in professional disputes. The APA, the American Psychological Association, and the Oregon Psychological Association officially supports prescription privileges. What you might not know is that the APA actually adopted this policy to pursue and actively and aggressively pursue prescription privileges by suspending parliamentary procedure. So it's not the rank and file of APA that got to decide on this issue. We're by far not a monolithic profession that fully supports prescription privileges for psychologists. In fact, surveys suggest a slim majority do. And fewer, even those that do support it, say, very few say that they would actually go ahead and get the additional training to be able to pursue these privileges. My second concern relates to the fact that granting prescription privileges to psychologists will very drastically, I would argue, affect professional training and education and the greater public in damaging ways. First of all, you think about what has been proposed, and it's very clear that a person could have really no science background, get into a doctoral program, complete their doctoral program, and get all of their medical and basic science training postdoctorally. And I would argue that there's concerns raised there. But if we want to mimic this model and push for clear medical training for psychologists, it's going to affect education at all levels in psychology, whether you're looking at an undergraduate experience, doctorate experience, or postdoctoral experience. And I don't think that Oregon colleges and universities have had an opportunity to weigh in on how that might impact what they do in training future psychologists, even those who are going to get a BA and may enter into other aspects of mental health. Adding faculty to departments of psychology to only teach a prescription curriculum would cost an estimated $800,000 to $1 million annually. I would argue very clearly that only schools wholly supported by tuition could hope to recover these costs, and most of those tend to be for-profit enterprises. My third major concern, I think, has been adequately addressed, safety concerns. You've heard this again and again and again. The only piece that I would offer that's unique is that we typically are relying, if you look at New Mexico and Louisiana, very clearly on... Am I out of time? Finish up your thought. Okay. That we are really relying on self-policing. So they point to Louisiana, New Mexico, and say there's been no adverse events, but it's self-policing, much in the same way that Dr. Kennemer was speaking about ethics. We're really pushing in a situation where we require people to do the ethical thing, or whether it's I mistreated a patient and I need to report that. And so I will sort of finish with my concluding thoughts, which is many of my concerns revolve around a lack of data. My colleagues who just spoke looked at lack of access. I refer you to Table 1 to look at what we know from Louisiana and New Mexico. I'm a social scientist. We should be looking at data. It very clearly suggests that we are not improving access to rural Americans by any stretch. We don't know if we're improving access to other populations that have a need. So that leads me to the question of why are we pushing for this controversial, dangerous bill? Why are we doing this? Well, pharmaceutical stands to benefit very clearly. For-profit training programs stand to benefit very clearly. And I would argue that psychologists who are in private practice and are business people also stand to benefit. I would argue Oregonians, consumers of mental health, will not benefit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. I have the Dash 4 amendments that I think we just received this morning. The issue here is around liability. Dr. Lace mentioned that as a concern from the pediatricians. Our family physicians have the same concern. In page 5, section 7 of the bill, it requires collaboration between a prescribing psychologist and a physician. Our physicians want to make certain that that collaboration of care does not carry liability with it, that the liability rests with the prescribing psychologist. I spoke with the proponents of the bill. They said that that was their intent all along, and they so they endorsed or supported the idea of this amendment. As I said, we just received the amendment this morning, so I have not had a chance to circulate it to my people yet, and other people are just taking a look at it as well. Just to call your attention to it, there is also a brief opinion from Legislative Council because this gets into the thorny issues around liability, and it touches on issues raised in Clark versus OHSU. They have have raised an issue. There may want to be an additional amendment dealing with allowing liability against collaborating healthcare professionals for gross negligence and wanton misconduct. So I'm not an attorney. I'm going to have to run that by other people to see whether that makes sense or not. I appreciate your time and your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Robert Julian from Lake Oswego. I am a longtime physician in Oregon since the late 70s. I also have a PhD in psychopharmacology. Somewhat unique here because I have no profit motives, no axes to grind, nothing like this. For the last 35 years, I have been an author of this textbook, which is titled A Primer of Drug Action. It was the very first and is today the most long-running and widest used textbook of psychopharmacology in the United States. I support prescribing psychologists. I've had significant experience with those in Louisiana. I lecture psychopharmacology throughout the United States. I've trained physicians, nurses, other personnel at all levels through all my years of practice. All of our clinical data coming out today, our research says optimal care of mental health diseases comes through collaborative care between psychological interventions and medical therapy. It was mentioned earlier that the pediatricians are seeing children coming in on 6 or 8 medications. This is nonsense. This is bad medicine. You can't just throw medications for mental health disorders. If you have diabetes, it's a collaboration between whoever prescribes and a dietitian, so you don't take your diabetes medicines with a piece of cake, and so on and so forth. It's complementary care that works. Today in mental health in this country and in this state, we just throw meds at people. You're depressed, you've got Lexapro, et cetera, et cetera. And it just, the data says it doesn't work. Here's an opportunity to take a group of specially trained people who, in my opinion, have adequate knowledge and understanding to incorporate this data and to allow them to judiciously use prescriptions as part of their overall management of the patient. This is not happening elsewhere. Maybe we can fly somebody around the state or do it by, maybe you can do a psych eval by telephone or TV. I don't know that that can be done successfully. It's an opportunity to do what the literature says is optimal, which is collaborative care. And therefore, I urge passage of the bill. Thank you very much.
One physician in favor? Okay, yes. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, and I recognize the time limitation, but just a very brief question. It has been represented by some psychologists, the clinical psychologists, that the ability to prescribe would diminish their
practice of social intervention.
Right, and that terminology escapes me, but I...
The risk in what's happened with, unfortunately, with many psychiatrists is to become medication managers. Instead of doing 50-minute interviews, you do 10-minute. That's not appropriate. To this date, in my knowledge with practitioner prescribing psychologists in Louisiana, this has not happened. They're still doing their 50-minute sessions, and the meds are used very judiciously. So far, in that situation, they have not become medication managers. I do not predict that that will happen here. Or I predict that that will stay here. They will still do their 50 minutes rather than becoming a medication manager.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Megan Cahy and Linnea Lindsay Pagelli. Mm-hmm. And might as well bring in Dr. Robin Henderson. Go ahead, Megan.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 1046. My name is Megan Cahy. I'm Vice President of Mental Health America of Oregon, which is an advocacy organization for mental health consumers, survivors. And it's in this capacity that I'm testifying today. I myself personally have been a mental health person who has a lot of experience over the past 30 years with mental health, with psychiatric medications. I have personally felt the side effects of the medications and have dealt with prescribers, mostly psychiatrists, of the medications. I know what it's like to have tardive dyskinesia, to have galactorrhea, pseudoparkinsonism. These are some of the side effects. They're devastating. What I would like to say is that I don't think this is a useful bill, because when I read the bill and I looked at the training that was required, I didn't think this was adequate training. People with serious mental illness are dying on average 25 years earlier than the general population. These are my peers. People with substance abuse and mental illness die approximately 32 to 37 years earlier than the general population. This is because we have many comorbid conditions, diabetes, heart disease, respiratory problems, because of smoking, because of HIV, obesity, because of the medications that we take. We are very complex, whole people that have very complex medical problems. We require providers that understand the complexities of our beings. I think that we need doctors that can treat us, that understand the psychobiology of our brains and the biology of our bodies. I think this needs to be a medical treatment as well as a psychobiology for the medications. I was very disturbed when I looked at the training requirements and saw that it included a month for people with geriatrics, the training required a month with pediatrics. I know I'm running out of time, but I would like to say I believe the psychologists mean well with their bill, but I think there's also a need for power for some people, and I don't think that is a good thing. I wish that on the work group there would have been a consumer survivor or several consumer survivors being heard. I believe that what's been missing in this discussion is the voice of people taking the drugs. And I would like to hear more from the people that are affected directly by the outcome of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Megan.
For the record, Dr. Robin Henderson and Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I will be brief. I am not an academic. I'm somebody who's been out in the real world working. I've been directing psychiatric units since 1997 as a licensed psychologist, and I just wanted to make a few points. This bill has the potential to mandate collaboration. Isn't that cool? We have the potential to mandate that two disciplines have to work together to look at the whole individual. We have to have a conversation before we prescribe a drug. We have to have those conversations about what you're talking about in terms of the physical health problems that folks have. I was recently looking at some studies in Deschutes County and looking at the numbers of folks who had passed away in just one little cohort in Deschutes County last year, and 11 people died. And two-thirds of those people died of chronic health conditions that were fully treatable, in large part because we don't have that mandated healthcare collaboration. I have never represented that this bill is the panacea for changing the access problems in this state, but I do think that this has the potential to move us towards a more integrated schema of care. One of the things about psychologists, and you know, I went to school for 9 years, I learned my basic assessment techniques. They haven't changed. And they wouldn't change if I went back to school and got a little bit more. I'll let Dr. Lindsay Bengeli address that. Because it's ingrained in me. Just like any profession, you learn your basic assessment techniques. It becomes part of the frame through the glasses through which you see. The most important thing we do is provide an accurate assessment and an accurate diagnosis. It doesn't matter what drugs you use. If you don't have a good diagnosis, guess what? Doesn't matter. Then all of a sudden you're just adding more agents to the body, creating more side effects, and creating this running stream of where you come up with six to eight drugs that somebody may be on at that point. Psychologists provide an accurate diagnosis, an accurate assessment, and always go for the least intrusive therapy. We're trained in all the different forms of talk therapy. We look at things like DBT, some of those other types of interventions that we use, all the other different types of talk therapy. That's the first line that we go to. In the 7 minutes you have in a family practice doctor's office, that's not the first thing you think about. The first thing you think about is, here's the script for what's going to make you feel better. The ability to prescribe is the ability to unprescribe. And that's one of the things that I think people miss in all of this. We're looking at an opportunity for better diagnostic, better assessments. This isn't about psychiatry. Oh my gosh, if 50% of the scripts were written by psychiatrists, I would be thrilled. We wouldn't be having this conversation. But they're not. It's 15 to 20%. And there was a cover story in Newsweek that really highlighted this just recently, and it says, it's all well and good to point out that psychotherapy is more effective than pills or placebos with dramatically lower relapse rate, but there's that little matter of reality. In the U.S., most patients with depression are treated by primary care physicians, not psychiatrists. The latter are in short supply, especially outside cities and especially for children and adolescents. We have to get to a point where we're getting the right practitioner in at the right time. And I thank you very much for your time on this bill.
Madam Chair, yes. Very briefly. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What do you mean a potential for collaboration? I thought Section 7 says that they will collaborate.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's more than a potential.
You are absolutely correct. I misspoke. Thank you, Senator.
It's a mandate. Yeah, it's a mandate to collaborate.
It's a mandate
yeah,
to collaborate.
Important. Otherwise, I would not even think of dealing with this.
Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. I appreciate that.
Senator Manas Anderson and members of the the Senate Health Care Committee, I'm Dr. Linnea Lindsay Pengelly. I come to you today from rural Oregon as a psychologist who's practiced in Hood River for 18 years. For centuries, we've sought out the wisdom of our elders when we are unable to solve things ourselves. The women who brought the baby to Solomon brought him to Solomon to make a decision about who had the right answer. We're unfortunately at that pass again. We have tried to go to a consensus mediation process to find the answer to this, but now we're back before you again and ask you to use your wisdom in looking at this issue with fresh eyes one more time. 7 years ago when I enrolled in the postdoctoral master's in clinical psychopharmacology, it wasn't because I was going to make more money. It was because, and I certainly haven't in the years intervening, it was because the work I was doing in rural Oregon in Hood River, where there was not an adult psychiatrist at any juncture that I could turn to, required me to work in collaboration with my peers in primary care. They asked me, I asked myself, to get more training. I tried to do it on an ad hoc basis by doing continuing education, reading, and doing those things, but it was not enough. So I went to pursue this postdoctoral master's to have an integrated, systematic format for learning. In the next decade, we're projected to have a 40% deficit in psychiatry throughout the nation. That will impact people in Oregon even more, particularly in underserved shortage areas. As we continue to push mental health over into a primary care treatment modality, we are not providing the citizens of our state with the kind of expert care that they need. So who are we going to ask to our citizens to see? Are we going to ask them to see the physician's assistant who has 2 quarters in neuroanatomy, 2 quarters in pharmacotherapeutics, and not a single healthcare course in mental health diagnosis, and nor a requirement for any clinical training in mental health diagnosis or treatment? Or are we going to ask the family nurse practitioner with 5 quarters of pharmacology and not a single course in diagnosis or treatment for mental health disorders required, not in their coursework nor in their training, their clinical training? Or are we going to ask the standard physician who has 8 weeks of neuroscience in their second year of medical school, 5 weeks of psychiatry in their third year of medical school, 4 weeks of neurology in their fourth year of medical school, and not a single requirement in their clinical training or residency that requires them to study mental health disorders, diagnosis, or treatment? A recent study that came out said that less than 25% of primary care providers use the DSM criterion for diagnosing mental health disorders. If less than 25% of primary care are using that to diagnose things like depression, how are we then choosing the medications that are necessary for these people? They are very vulnerable. Or do you want to choose the psychologist who has 4 years of training in mental health diagnosis, 2,000 hours of pre-doctoral internship, 2,000 hours of postdoctoral internship, who then adds the postdoctoral master's degree and another 18 months of physician-supervised clinical training to provide the treatment for the people of Oregon? I ask you to consider this. On the backside of my testimony, it does include our coursework and includes the kind of clinical biochemistry, neurosciences, neurochemistry, neurophysiology, neuroanatomy, clinical medicine, physical assessment, and all of the other things that we do in this panel. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Now, we have 2 more people to testify, but before you leave, there were some amendments. Who can briefly describe the amendments?
I would be happy to, Chairman.
All right, yes.
The dash 3 are ours. There was a typo in the dash 2s, but the dash 3s are ours. And then you have the dash 4s before you, correct?
Right, the dash 4s we've had explained to us, so...
Okay, I can't address the dash 5s and the dash 1s, and I'm looking for my dash 3s. And I don't have them. My apologies. May I go get them really quick?
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
While we're waiting for... I want to take a moment to thank all the people who've come today in the last few days over a very difficult issue. I'm certainly not Solomon, don't feel like Solomon, and don't have his wisdom. One of the things I've not heard in this discussion, I'm kind of waiting for it to come forward, and maybe it's not going to come forward, so I want to take a moment to address it. There is another avenue for dealing with this. I just think saying no is not an option. You just can't say no to people. We have to offer another plan. And during the last session, we talked about asking psychologists who had the interest and the background to go into psychopharmacology to enter into a PA program, mm-hmm. a program that's already set up for writing prescription writing privileges, automatically has collaboration built into the program with the specialists or primary care physicians, and a program we have at OHSU. We're talking about a very small number of psychologists who probably be entering these programs, no matter which one we go with or none. And I just was waiting to hear that discussion come up today. I was hoping it would. To me, that is an efficient, effective, and reasonable way to move this program forward. If a psychologist wants to become a prescriber, become a PA, the amount of training and time is very similar. We're talking 18 to 24 months here to get through the program proposed, and it's similar to that to simply become a PA and resolve the issue is another method for people to go through that program. Now, it may not be quite that simple. You might have to develop a specific program in the PA system for that. I think it's doable. But I've been waiting for that discussion to come up, and I don't hear it coming up. I think it's the option that I would rather see exercise this issue. It might resolve most issues for all parties here, that a practicing psychologist would have an opportunity to become a prescriber by going through a specified PA program hosted probably at OHSU or somewhere else in the state. That's just a suggestion I've waited to hear and have not heard.
And I know that we have discussed that in the past, and there is reaction to why certain psychologists don't feel it's appropriate. Let them answer the question, and then Senator Morissette.
I'd like to say that there's over 700 people who apply for the PA programs in our state, and there's less than 30 positions. We really need the PAs to be primary care providers in our state. We're already in a shortage of health care providers, and if we usurp some of those positions into a prescribing psychology piece, we're talking about adding to the number of health care providers, and if we take positions out of our current training programs, we're already only allowing in 10% of the applicants to the programs that we have. We'd have to build new programs.
Madam Chair, I'm not suggesting that. It's an expansion mm-hmm. of the program for psychiatrists. We would also note that we're doubling the number of medical students in the state within the next 2 years, the new medical school being opened up at 11, so that's not really part of the discussion. The discussion is could we develop that kind of a program in addition to what we have to allow direct entry that way.
And Senator, I'd like to actually answer the question from the perspective of someone who was on the work group. We did look at that curriculum. We did look at this in comparison to the academic curriculum from the postdoctoral master's in clinical psychopharmacology. And the work group reached consensus that the postdoctoral master's in clinical psychopharmacology better met the needs of what we were looking for in our model program. So we did consider that option, and that's probably why you didn't hear it, because we had discussed that within the context of the work group quite a lot. That was one of our easier consensus pieces.
Well, the other issues are outside that work group, so I understand.
Senator Morissette.
Well, I was just wondering what prerequisites a psychologist would have to get into that program. Would they have to go back and take other medical training? And you don't have to answer that, but that's what I'm wondering. And if there are 700 people applying in a very few positions and only 10% are taken, there's some reason why that may not work.
Okay, my apologies. I have the dash threes if you'd like.
Yes.
Basically, in the dash threes, this places the formulary under the medical board in collaboration with the state board of psychologist examiners, which was the intention of the work group and was not labeled correctly within here, and does the same thing with the little language around standards of continuing education and training. And then, as Doug Barber said, we would support the dash fours as well.
Okay. So fours and threes, and I believe that the dash ones were from the Oregon Medical Association and Oregon Psychiatric Association, but they dropped those. They don't want to consider those,
okay.
And so it's just the threes and fours that we would be looking at. Okay. I know that there is Tom Mann who says he doesn't really need to testify, but he wanted to just make a comment on the patients, veterans who needed care, and then Bill Dehan.
Supposed to get out now. That's okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom.
Okay, hold it, hold it. Dr. Bates?
I have a quick one.
Yeah. Let's be in recess just for a minute. Open a work session. Oh, we're back on. Are we back on? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1046. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1010. I would like to have
you to make the motion.
The motion. Entertain a motion on Senate Bill 1010.
Madam Chair, I'd entertain a motion on Senate Bill 1010 that we pass out with a due pass recommendation to
Senator Bates.
The Senate floor
moves that Senate Bill 1010 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
No.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair Monsanders?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Morissette will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1010 and resume Senate Bill 1046. Senator Bates has to go to a press conference
that
real quick.
As quick as I can.
Okay. All right.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and you're probably wondering what the heck I'm doing here. Senator Bates caught me in the hall the other day and asked if I would come clarify some issues revolving around VA health care that came up during testimony on Tuesday. I have a great presentation that I won't give, but I'll tell you this. When you apply for VA health care, within 30 days, you'll get notified whether you're accepted, and then a primary care appointment will be made for you. VA healthcare is like a closed system, like Kaiser Permanente. You have to be in the system to get your prescriptions. You go to VA doctors. You get your health care from primary care physicians, from specialists that you're referred to. It's a pretty good system that way. What's important to know to address the issues from last Tuesday, yes, medications are mailed. I've been in the system for 21 years, and all my meds were mailed to me, so you can get medication mailed. There are mental health care providers in all the community-based clinics, and there are clinics in Bend, Brookings, Burns, Eugene, Grants Pass, Hillsborough, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, North Bend, Ontario, Portland, Salem, Warrenton, and soon coming to you, West Lynn and Lincoln City. So there are places to go for mental health. There are also vet centers that do post-deployment readjustment, post-traumatic stress disorder. They are located in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Grants Pass, and one coming to Deschutes County in Bend within this year. So to answer the questions, yes, there is access issues in terms of time, probably a month before you get your first primary care appointment. Probably take it 2-3 weeks to get into the clinic when you call for an appointment. Your meds are mailed to you. It is a closed system. You cannot have a private doctor write a script for you and bring that to the VA and have it filled. You can bring it to one of your VA doctors, though, and say, can you write me a new one on this, and they will fill it for you that way. I hope that answers the questions from last Tuesday.
And I think that the concern was for these patients that sometimes their medical situation, especially with mental health, changes, and they need to access care right away. And many of them actually had a psychologist rather than the psychiatrist in the VA because they needed constant monitoring, whether it was, well, I think they were both post-traumatic stress disorders. So I think the point was that there are people in the system that need assistance other than just within the VA system. But I think you and I have had this conversation, and I would love to open up the VA system where there are clinical providers and other modalities that could help our vets. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is William Dean, and I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I have a private practice located at 1940 Northeast Broadway in Portland, and I'm here today to advocate for any amendment to this bill, really, that supports the need for some type of general health science prerequisite material for this group of providers prior to and independent of any kind of prescriptive authority training. And with respect to that, I'd just like to make two very basic points. My first is simply to highlight the prerequisite courses for Oregon's Pacific University Doctorate in Psychology program. There are actually no basic health science course is required as a prerequisite to application for that program. There are, however, four psychology classes that are required, four out of eight, which can actually be in progress at the time of application. The reason I'm mentioning this is because with respect to caring for a patient pharmacologically, really no amount of psychology classes is going to take the place of biology 101, let alone a year of anatomy and physiology. As to that year of anatomy and physiology, what I'm referring to is a three-term series of ANP, which is taken by nearly all healthcare providers currently, nurses, physical therapists, even naturopaths, sonographers, dental hygienists. You really can't even begin training to clean someone's teeth in the state of Oregon unless you've had a year of anatomy and physiology behind you as a prerequisite. The idea that psychologists would be learning to train to treat patients with drugs without first taking a year of anatomy and physiology does present kind of a dilemma, because if proponents of this bill are arguing that that course material is covered within their prescriptive training program, those are not exactly graduate-level courses. It's a gross misrepresentation to spend time covering rudimentary, basic health science prerequisite information and attempt to call that medical training. On the other hand, if I were to skip those courses entirely and claim to have a graduate-level education to treat patients with drugs without first ever having had the benefit of a single biology class, I really don't know anyone outside of this room who would argue that that seems like it's really in the best interest of patient care. So the good news is prerequisite courses in sciences can be knocked out of the way in a relatively short span of time, from 12 to 24 months. And I guess that's all I have to say on the matter.
Well, just to let you know that the work group did consider all of the education, and there were actually three psychiatrists from OHSU, two psychiatrists.
One physician.
And one physician, yeah. And so they did look at the training, and the consensus was the result in this bill, just for your information. I know you weren't a part of that. Excellent. All right. With that, we will be bringing this bill back on Tuesday. We will not be necessarily needing any testimony at that point in time. We now will be talking to our individual caucuses, seeing if there are the votes. We just need to get a lay of the land and where, if any, amendments need to happen. Yes, yeah. Senator Morris.
Well, the reason I asked Dr. Bate or raised that question earlier about just taking a PA course for 2 years, are there prerequisites? And I think you answered that question. So if you don't have the basic human anatomy biology classes, it's hard to build on something that you don't have. And
precisely. It's pretty hard to take, for instance, neuroanatomy and biochemistry when you haven't first taken Chemistry 101.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that kind of answers that. Well, I have to talk to Doc Bates more about what his idea was. But anyway, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1046, and we are adjourned.